This is an ABC podcast.
AUKUS is the hot topic of conversation. Some say we've been sucked too far into the US vortex. Would they say that if we're a bit closer to China, like Vietnam and Japan? We'll take a look at that. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone, and this is Counterpoint. Far away from our region in Europe, energy supply is an enormous issue. And is Europe about to commandeer renewables from Africa? Can Africa do without the energy? And what about the environment? Environmentalists, of course, are not alone in worrying about endangered species. And there is good news. 29 of our threatened species are back from the brink. But first to Stalin, or rather Putin. Are they really quite similar? We're hearing more and more about Putin. But what about Stalin? You know, he was revered at one point, then despised, and then starting to be revered again. And how does he compare with Putin? Well, there's one way to find out about that, and that's to speak to James Ryan. He's the lecturer in modern European, that is Russian, history at Cardiff University in Wales, and he joins us now. James Ryan, was Stalin as bad as everyone says?
Depends on what everybody says, I guess. He was a pretty nasty political ruler. When we think about the worst possible political rulers in history, there's a reason why we often think of Hitler, Stalin, and maybe now Putin in that same conversation. But yeah, he's not somebody that I would have wanted to decide my fate, let's put it like that. Although, as a historian, I would be fascinated to sit down and have dinner with him and have a conversation.
Sure. Well, who wouldn't? Well, I mean, if I knew they couldn't get me, I'd sit down and have dinner with a serial killer to see if I could understand how they worked. Now, with all the work that you've done, have you got any endearing stories about Stalin? I've got a view that even the nicest people you know have got a dark side somewhere, however small it is. You know, something nasty they've done or said or whatever. And equally, the people you dislike the most have got something endearing about them. They might stop and help a little kid cross the street or save a puppy from being run over. They've got something. Have you got any nice stories about Stalin?
I do. You know, funnily enough, last week I was in London. I spent the last month in London looking through Stalin's archive. And the reason I was in London is because Stalin's archive has been digitized. So we don't actually have to be in Moscow, and I can't really be in Moscow at the moment because of the war. So I've been going through his archive for the last month, and one of the really endearing things that comes out of his archive are these little notes from his young daughter, Svetlana, to her father, who was the dictator of the Soviet Union, basically saying, Papa, I want to go to the cinema. Will you take me? And Stalin typically writes out a very formal response on his formal headed paper, you know, playing to his daughter and saying, yes, I'll take you to the cinema. So we do actually get a glimpse that there really was a human being there. And there was. Stalin was a charming individual. However brutal he could be, and he was also a charming individual who commanded loyalty and commanded love and was capable of love. He was very, very human. We shouldn't think of him as a monster. He was very human. And maybe that's what's so chilling about him, that he wasn't a monster.
I think that is certainly right from my point of view, that when you realise the nice part of someone, you realise there's darkness probably in everyone. And what you have to worry about is how does it grow and jump out and get even bigger than it's meant to be, the little grain of sand in us.
Absolutely.
It becomes, for some people, a bucket load. Now, what's happened to his reputation over time, Stalin? Amongst Russians, I mean.
Amongst Russians. Well, if we look specifically at Russia, he was hugely popular, actually, during his lifetime. There is this great film that we have in 1953 when he died, this sort of film of his funeral where you can see a genuine outpouring of grief. There was also a lot of fear directed towards him. But then a few years later, his successor, Nikita Khrushchev, very unexpectedly denounced him. And that led to somewhat of a dip in his personality. But anyway, to cut a long story short, Stalin remained relatively popular in the Soviet Union until pretty much close to the collapse of the Soviet Union itself. And then things changed, and then his popularity really fell down. But over the last few years, that has changed.
What was it that caused the fall? I mean, you equate it with about the time the Soviet Union fell apart, but that doesn't necessarily mean his popularity should fall. Was there some instigator of that fall?
Part of the reason that Stalin's popularity fell around that time is when the Soviet Union was collapsing and Mikhail Gorbachev, the late Mikhail Gorbachev, was in power, he opened up conversation about the Soviet past. And this led to opening of opportunity to condemn Stalin, denounce Stalin, and talk about all that was bad about the Stalin era. And so that then led to a decline in Stalin's reputation. There were always people, and always have been people in Russia, who have remained very staunch Stalin supporters. But that popularity really fell around the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union and stayed down for quite some time. But yeah, in 2019, there was an opinion poll published in Russia, which generated headlines through much of the world, actually, that apparently, according to this opinion poll, 70% of Russians had a positive view of Stalin's role in Russian history, which seems extraordinary and seems almost impossible for us to understand. I mean, what if 70% of Germans had a popular view of Hitler? But I would suggest that there's actually a lot of complexity behind that statement, and we shouldn't maybe take it just at face value. There's more going on if we dig down.
Okay. Now, parallels between Stalin and Putin, are they a bad idea?
Yeah. No, I think it's a very natural idea, because when we try to make sense of the world around us, we reach for historical analogies. We look for those examples from the past that might allow us to make better sense of what's going on. And so if we're looking at Russia today, and I would argue that Russia under Putin has become a dictatorship, then we think, well, has Russia ever been a dictatorship before? And then we realize, oh, actually it has. Mm-hmm. In fact, it really hasn't ever been a solid democracy. But the most terrifying example of a dictatorship in Russian history comes from the time when Stalin ruled Russia and the wider Soviet Union. That's when we see the most extreme and the most horrendous dictatorship behavior by the state. And so I think there's good reason for us to draw those parallels. And I think there are real parallels to be drawn. I think what we're seeing in Russia today under Putin is a revival of some of that dictatorial model that was established, or at least perfected or consolidated, under Stalin's rule. And so there are some parallels to be drawn, but, and I would say this as a historian, we should be careful not to over-egg that analogy. We should be careful not to think that it's simply a repeat of Stalinism. Putin isn't Stalin, and this isn't Stalinism Mark II.
No. Okay, now Russia's rulers, as you say, acknowledged and condemned the crimes of the Stalin regime against its own people. And Putin dedicated a memorial wall to the victims, as you say. But given we've just discussed 70% of Russians not thinking that badly of him, how is it that in 2018, more Russians than not seem to think he was an inhuman tyrant?
Yeah. I spent some time working through these opinion polls. These opinion polls, by the way, come from the Levada Center, which is an internationally recognized or quite a famous opinion poll sociological center in Moscow. It's not controlled by the state. And honestly, when I was reading through those opinion polls, I almost felt like pulling my hair out, because
they don't sit together do they?
They don't. They really don't. And this might sound like a cop-out, and maybe it is, but intellectually, I like contradiction. I'm comfortable with it. It's part of, I guess, my training as a historian. People are complex. People are full of contradictions.
Yeah. Well, and it does invite interest and questions. I mean, the mere fact I've seen that and think, now, how does that work? A contradiction sparks your interest, and that's probably a good thing. Can we say, even though, you know, Putin's not Stalin, that decades of the Stalin regime that, you know, grandparents of people now live through, at least till the soil for the sort of regime that Putin has now built up?
Yes. Yes, I think so. And I think part of that is, if we look at the Putin regime today, One of its very effective mechanisms for staying in power, maintaining its rule, maintaining its dictatorship, is the relative passivity of the people. You know, people are not all that necessarily politically engaged. I mean, I've heard this many times living in Russia, even speaking with some of my friends in Russia since this full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year. There's sometimes a tendency, and I guess we could hear this in many societies, but it's quite pronounced in Russia. There's sometimes a tendency to think, that's politics, and it's not my business. And if you grow up in a democracy, in a democratic society, you know, like Australia, like Britain, wherever it might be, we tend to learn that it is our business, that, you know, we live in a democracy, we get to vote for our government, our rulers, they dispose of our money, our taxes that we work for. And it kind of is our business, because that's what we should be thinking if we are to be responsible, engaged citizens. A lot of Russians are inclined to think, no, that's not my business. And there is that division between what in Russian is called vlast, which means power, the state, and us. Now, this isn't the case for every Russian, of course, but there's a real tendency there. Where does that come from? That comes from decades of dictatorship. It comes from decades of trauma, of generational trauma that's passed through generations, where if generations of people have suffered trauma, you learn from your parents and from your grandparents, shut up, keep quiet, keep your head down, and don't get involved. And that in itself is sort of sowing the ground for the type of political culture that we do see existing in Russia, and not only in Russia. And that helps. And this is also interesting when we look at propaganda, when we look at the propaganda of the Putin regime. I mean, broadly speaking, it's doing a few things, the Kremlin's propaganda. But we shouldn't think of the propaganda of the Kremlin regime as something that Putin and his cronies necessarily want all Russians to believe. I mean, in some respects, it's great if Russians believe it from their perspective.
What should we think of it as? I mean, that's the purpose of propaganda, isn't it?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
It can be. And in the Stalin regime, that was the purpose of propaganda, because Stalin wanted everybody to believe the propaganda of the regime and become responsible socialist citizens, bizarrely enough. But he really did want that. Distrust is a key function of Putin's propaganda. If you can sow distrust, that's very
weakening.
Useful.
Weakening.
Exactly. Sure. Because what people are saying, and I've heard Russians say this, oh, you know, we don't believe our state TV, but we also don't believe the BBC or CNN or, ABC.
We believe in nothing.
Who do we believe? And so we don't believe in this, we don't believe in that. In other words, there's this opinion, there's that opinion. Who am I to say which opinion is right or wrong? And so when it comes to this war in Ukraine, you know, I'd say, well, you know, maybe our government has done a really bad thing, but also maybe there are fascists in Ukraine, and also isn't it all about NATO? So in some respects, it's about, as you say, weakening a sense of popular resolve. And that can be a really useful ally to a dictatorship.
Now, James Ryan, I think you've opened my mind vis-a-vis Stalin and Putin, and I've very much enjoyed our conversation. So after many years in politics, I'll leave you with one lesson from politics that you probably have already learnt from history, and it's this. Doubt is the most powerful weapon, and the creation of distrust is the creation of doubt. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterpoint.
I think that's so, so important, actually. Doubt, it comes across so often in what I study. I think that's such an important thing to think about. This was such a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on.
Putin certainly makes us think of geopolitics, and geopolitics makes us think of AUKUS. AUKUS. Gee, you could read any number of stories on AUKUS. Whether we're doing the right thing, whether we're not doing the right thing. Is it too big? Is it too long? Is it too far? Is it too much? Is it a great idea? Well, we're going to talk to Aaron Sarin. We've talked to him before, of course. He's a freelance journalist in the United Kingdom, in Sheffield in particular, and he specialises in China and the CCP, so he's just the man to speak to. Aaron Sarin, welcome back to Counterpoint. And look, I have to ask, you started this article talking about a team of Victorian police officers. Now, you're in Sheffield. So how did that happen?
Well, AUKUS is an agreement between the UK, the US and Australia. I try to stay abreast of what's happening everywhere if I can. Basically, I consider that AUKUS is a completely necessary and vital reaction to Beijing's growing militarization, growing aggression, a threat which is global. So I think it concerns everybody. I think a Taiwan war is a very real possibility. And so we need to deter the Communist Party as much as possible. I worry it's too little, and I worry that we've been too slow. We, meaning the democratic world, the West, but still it's better than nothing. I think it's a move in the right direction.
Okay. But, Aaron, how did you find out about the Victorian police officers flying a Chinese flag over the station at Box Hill?
I recall reading about that a while ago. I don't know if it was in 2019 when it actually happened or if it was shortly afterwards, but I recalled that it seemed to me like a symbolic moment, an accidentally symbolic moment where I think these police officers didn't realise what it looked like, didn't realise what they were doing. I think they thought they were being culturally sensitive, perhaps. In fact, they were showing the extent to which Beijing had got its claws or its tentacles into Australian society. Of course, this is a beautiful moment for the party, seeing their flag flying over an Australian police station.
Indeed. Now, China has obviously been extending its influence, both in terms of hard power and soft power. What do you think are the best examples of the stretch of Chinese power around the world? What are the biggest warning signs you think we should be looking at?
There are many. I think perhaps the way that it's sneaking into the United Nations, I think that might be a key warning sign. So the party is slithering into UN agencies and changing language, attempting to get its terms like win-win cooperation and mutual respect into UN documents. Basically, it is trying to gain access to the international system and then to subvert it and to remake the system in the model of its own totalitarian form of government.
Mutual respect, sort of a polite way of saying keep out of our business. Don't tell us what we should do with the Uyghurs or whatever. I mean, it's quite powerful language, but it's there to tell everyone else to nick off.
Yeah, these are deceptive, sugary phrases. The idea behind them is that everybody stops interfering in everyone else's business. It no longer becomes legitimate to raise concerns with how a particular government is treating its people. If you're not part of that nation, then it's none of your business. But that's the idea behind an idea like mutual respect.
Yeah. And as you say, you describe it as slithering into UN agencies. As examples, you point out that a Chinese national now heads the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and it gets $20 million from Beijing each year to advance the Belt and Road Initiative within the UN system. So that's a pretty powerful sort of thing, and the people who get to decide how all that money's spent are the Secretary-General, of course, his office, Chief of Staff and stuff, the Chinese Permanent Representative of the UN, and the Chinese Ministry of Commerce and Foreign Ministry. So that in itself has an impact on how the UN is seen around the world, seen through the eyes of China being a very positive force. It's quite neat. And apparently you also headed the International Civil Aviation Organization. I didn't know that. Or the International Telecommunication Union. So it's all moving on there. That's true. Now, what about in the South China Sea and Taiwan?
This is the key area. This is why I think AUKUS is so important. I think the People's Liberation Army, which is the military wing of the Chinese Communist Party, they will invade Taiwan. I think they've given us numerous clear signs now. Within the next decade, the plan currently is to invade Taiwan. And if that happens, that's a disaster, not just for Taiwan, but for the whole world. For Australia and countries in the periphery, there is an immediate threat because Pax Americana collapses, basically. The guarantee that America will defend its allies. If America doesn't come in and defend Taiwan here, then Pax Americana collapses immediately. If America does, then still this is disaster. There's no guarantee of a US and Taiwan victory. And also just a war will be an economic catastrophe. There'll be a global depression, almost certainly. I think Elon Musk said the global economy will take a 30% hit. That's his personal estimate. So any outcome at all of a China-Taiwan war is a disaster for the world.
Mm. The Chinese government and their leadership talk about the age of the Chinese civilization, but there are others who write that they're conveniently forgetting that a lot of the parts of China weren't originally part of China as it was. It wasn't a country as it is now. It's come together over time, but seem to claim this thousands and thousands of years of culture. And of course, for that reason, think they can claim Tibet, Xinjiang, Taiwan, the whole lot, simply because Chinese emperors controlled them in the past. You say that logic could be extended to Vietnam and Korea. Is that right?
In the past, dynastic emperors have invaded what we now call Vietnam and Korea. So if the current Chinese leadership is saying that Tibet was controlled by dynastic rulers in the past, so was Xinjiang and even Taiwan, therefore they somehow now belong to China forever, they're the eternal Chinese territory, it's not necessarily anything to stop them extending that to Vietnam and to Korea. And a successful invasion of Taiwan would put the Chinese Communist Party in a much more powerful position, in a position where it may make a move on these countries. And I think they're aware of this as well. So public feeling is pretty anti-Beijing in both of those countries.
Yeah, one of the things you raised which struck a chord with me is the degree to which the Chinese kids at school are reminded of the horrors of what happened when China was at war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are kids who'd grow up thinking it'd be okay if every Japanese person was sort of wiped out. And you say it's drilled into the minds of every Chinese mainlander at school. And then you add, along with the hatred they are expected to feel towards every single blameless descendant. Now, the reason that struck a chord is I think that's happening all over the world, not in the Chinese context, but for example, with slavery. You know, people who've had nothing to do with slavery at all are now expected to feel guilt, as in some sort of personal responsibility, for what happened in the past. We certainly have some of that in Australia, where the Indigenous community was not fairly treated by some of the colonial people, not at all. I mean, that's an understatement, very badly treated in some cases, not all. And I personally get the feeling that what's developing in Australia is a view that, you know, we're all to blame, whereas we're not. Chinese migrants here, Vietnamese migrants here, Polish migrants here, Ukrainian migrants here, they're not to blame. They are the blameless descendants or the blameless new immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was just something we dealt with, but you say the Chinese are doing the same thing vis-a-vis Japan.
Yeah, we're in a pretty dangerous moment right now, I think, because we have the same problem that's from within and without. So within Western democracies, there's this idea that the sins of the fathers are visited on the sons, this old idea. So yeah, an individual who happens to have white skin or whatever carries with them the guilt of past individuals who they're not related to at all, who they have no connection to, who committed various crimes. That's encouraged, that kind of thing, in Western democracies by Chinese propaganda, but they're pushing the same thing from without as well. So yes, a dangerous idea that is more prevalent now, I think, than it was a decade ago.
Now, of course, the microchip developments in Taiwan, something everybody wants to have control of, the Chinese in particular would like that. So that aspect would be devastating if China got to control 80% of the semiconductor production. But equally importantly, as you point out, there's 24 million people in less than 10,000 square kilometres in Taipei. And, you know, that's nearly 10,000 a square kilometre. That's amazing. 24 million people into very dense urban areas. So if there is a war, the personal injuries and deaths are going to make anything that's happening in Ukraine look like a tea party. They have to. That small space and that many people, you could not conduct a war and not have horrific suffering. Do you agree?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think this is the most important reason why we need to deter as much as possible. Taking a strong position is the way to do this, making Beijing understand that it can't win a war. If it goes to war with Taiwan, this could be the end of the party. We need to hammer that home, and everybody needs to get on board.
Mm. Aaron, you finish your article by quoting the much-used saying, if you want peace, prepare for war. And I just wonder if you've heard the little paragraph out of John Kennedy's inaugural speech where he said, "We dare not tempt them with weakness, for only when our arms are sufficient beyond doubt can we be certain beyond doubt that they will never be employed." I'm a bit of a fan of Kennedy, and I'm a fan of that view too. When you've got the bigger knife, as Crocodile Dundee showed us, the smaller people with smaller knives tick off. Aaron Sarin, thanks for joining us today again on Counterpoint. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Oh, don't they drive you mad? People who just don't listen. You can explain to them why you don't agree, and they come out with the infamous, "yes, but," and on they go to repeat whatever their particular issue is in the same way as they did 5 minutes before, and they continue to do it. It's as if in our general conversation, many have become debaters rather than conversationalists. They want to beat your view down rather than understand what you're saying. Lately, I've decided to reverse the tennis ball straight back at them, using the old, "interesting, why do you say that?" Do that when they're paused, of course, so they have to keep going. And then as soon as they stop, "are you sure about this?" And another one, "have you heard any different perspectives?" Now, don't answer your own question. Just ask. So they have to keep talking, and worse for them, they have to keep thinking, and they'll move away. Speaking of people who don't listen, I love listening to our next guest. Clean energy. Everybody wants it. More of it, more of it. Let's have clean energy. Not many people are looking at how you get that clean energy. What are the consequences of the mining you need to do, the land you need to take up? And then, of course, in the end, disposal of clean energy equipment when it reaches its end life. One really interesting aspect of people not thinking much further than the simplistic, "oh, we need clean energy," is what's happening to countries that have got it, and is the West, if you like, just chewing up what it wants at the expense of other people? And in this context, you can ask, in the scramble for clean energy, Europe is turning to North Africa, and is that fair? To find out about that, we're going to talk to our regular correspondent, Fred Pearce. He's in London at the moment. You've heard him before. He's an author and journalist, writes on a whole lot of things, including for Yale Environment 360. And he joins us now from London. Fred Pearce, thanks for joining us again. Do you think countries in Europe are misusing Africa?
We've always misused Africa, I think, in one way or another. We regard it as a place to go and get the resources that we need, whether it's metals or whatever it may be. And now it looks like renewable energy. We look yearning across the Mediterranean to North Africa, to the Sahara, and we think, wow, so much space. You could fit Europe into the Sahara, and there are very few people there, and it's very sunny and surprisingly windy in places as well. So there's been a lot of talk for a number of years now in Europe about setting up giant solar farms, wind farms along the Atlantic coast, to harvest up these renewable resources and then send them down heavy-duty cables to supply the electricity that we need in Europe. It's very enticing, but it doesn't have a lot to say about what this means for Africa.
No. I mean, laying high-voltage submarine cables for 2,300 miles, I mean, it's not easy to grasp that sitting at a desk. 2,300 miles from energy farms in the Moroccan desert, past the lines of, you say, Portugal, Spain, and France to southwest England. I mean, heavens above. How much energy is used in building all those high-voltage submarine cables?
I've not seen a number for that. I mean, there are some sensible ideas, perhaps, for putting cables across the Mediterranean. So Morocco to Spain, that's a short jump. Egypt to Malta and Greece, that's not so far. Tunisia to Italy, also been talked about. So that's not so far. But then there's this crazy idea for running a cable from the southern tip of Morocco. So, you know, getting on down the West African coast, bypassing Spain and France and coming all the way to land it in southwest England, which, as you say, is more than a couple of thousand miles. That cable would cost a huge amount of money. But of course, if you build a big enough solar farm at the other end, you can perhaps recoup your money for that. And not only that, you would provide Britain with the renewable energy which it desperately needs. We've got good wind energy around UK waters. You know, out in the North Sea, it's pretty windy, but we don't have a lot of solar energy. The sun is pretty fitful here. So the idea of tapping into the Sahara's solar energy is terribly, terribly enticing, if, of course, you can persuade bankers to put up the money.
Mm. Well, if we look at both Morocco and Egypt, I mean, they've both got huge renewable energy plants. I think there's a reasonable question about putting aside whether it's feasible to get this energy to Europe and how to do that. What about whether that energy belongs in Africa, allowing African countries to develop?
Well, I think the African people would say, yes, it's our energy. Now, it's true that in Morocco and in Egypt, most people are hooked up to national grids, perhaps a little fitfully, and maybe they don't take that much energy from it, but they're hooked up. But if you look more widely, across Africa, only about half of the continent is hooked up to anything like reliable electricity supply. So you might say that at a continental level, this should be Africa's electricity rather than Europe's electricity. And Morocco, for instance, already has cable links. It has a kind of international grid connecting it up with most countries in West Africa, many of which have very little electricity, so it could do it. And similarly, Egypt is connected up to countries with poor electricity supplies through East Africa. So you might reasonably say that this power should be going south rather than north.
Mm, indeed. I mean, it's all very well for me to sit in a chair and moralise about Western Europe, but, you know, they've developed with a huge amount of energy. And you look at some countries in Africa that haven't got that opportunity and wonder whether it's all entirely fair. Having said that, of course, these countries aren't giving the energy away. They're selling the energy. And so money is going back into those countries, presumably, to help develop those countries at least. What about the environmental impacts? I've read people saying, oh, Australia's great, you know, we've got swathes of, you know, unused land in the sense that it hasn't been tilled for agriculture. So we could grow biomass there, or we can cover it with solar panels. And environmentalists, some of them anyway, rightly say, well, hold on, what's going to happen to the natural ecosystem if you do that? The animals that need the sunshine that's going to be sucked up by the panels, or the plants and bugs that were growing there that are going to be removed when you start growing biomasses. What are the consequences in Africa? Some of these stations are enormous. I mean, just incredible in size.
They're going to cover hundreds of square miles. So yes, they are huge and they cover huge areas. Now, the government's promoting these projects and yes, they'll get revenue from them, which they say they will create jobs, they will allow infrastructure development in remote parts of the country. And you can see that roads might be built and other stuff may happen. But as in these things always, you know, the money tends to go to different people. And there's a lot of local concern in parts of Morocco, certainly, about You know, this is not empty land. We talk about desert, but mostly it's arid land, which is used as pasture by herding communities, traditional communities across the region, and they feel left out, partly because the money probably won't come to them, but more particularly because the ecosystems on which they rely and which their livestock rely is going to be taken over. That's the fear. And there are other political dimensions as well. Part of what Morocco has planned, for instance, will extend into territory to the south of Morocco called Western Sahara, which Morocco has controlled for several decades now since Europeans left, but under international law and under the resolutions of the UN, is not Moroccan territory and is entitled to self-rule. So there are local politics about who has charge of the land and whether the government is coming in and taking over communally owned pasture land owned by tribal communities. But there are also some pretty big political stakes, particularly over the future of Western Sahara, which many of the liberation movements people in Western Sahara believe that this whole extension of renewable energy onto their territory is really about taking over their lands permanently and hooking their lands into the Moroccan economy and the Moroccan national grid. So there's some pretty high stakes here. And of course, some investors will be concerned that maybe they put some money into these projects and then, you know, suddenly there's a civil war going on.
Could be. Fred, I've got family that live in the western region of New South Wales. They wouldn't call it remote, but most people who live in a city would. You know, it's an hour to the, well, it's maybe 2 hours to a decent size town, but an hour and a half into a, you know, smaller little country town. And one of the things that really annoys, well, my sister in particular, is when people go out there for a time in the bush and they say, isn't it wonderful? There's nothing. And there's not nothing. That's how whatever God you believe in created it. That's everything. That's the world as it was created. And people from developed areas don't seem to recognize when they're looking at undeveloped country, they're looking at nature as it's meant to be. And here we go, sticking wind farms and solar energy farms all over. It's not nothing there. There is an ecosystem there. But in addition to that, there are, as you mentioned, people that use it. Now, you mentioned one of the sites being looked at is a place called Tantan, long-standing Saharan cultural traditions, where 30 nomadic tribes gather for a huge religious, cultural and trade fair. A camel racing. I've never seen a camel race. We do have camel racing in Australia, but I've not seen it. Now, the gathering is recognised by UNESCO, but soon this gathering of 30 nomadic tribes, it must be fabulous to be at, can be hemmed in by these energy plants. Have you ever been to that festival?
I've never been. No, I'd love to. These are great events, and the rest of the world is only beginning to catch up with the cultural importance of them. But even as we begin to learn about them and more people want to go to them, they are coming under threat from all sorts of reasons. So, yeah, I mean, my bottom line here is that the decisions about this land should be taken by the local people rather than distant governments sitting in cities, because it's the local people who use the land day in, day out, who understand the land day in, day out. These are the people, whoever they are, who are going to be in the best position, both democratically, but also just by understanding the land and how it's worked, what best to do. So I'm usually in favor of local decision-making on these things. And we often find that if there's a valuable resource, governments kind of get their claws into it and the local people lose out. And that's unfair, but it also doesn't work. The results are usually fairly catastrophic, whether you're talking about the loss of rainforest because somebody's taking over the forests that indigenous people have long since protected, or whether you're talking about these kind of arid ecosystems. And as you will know well, in Australia, you know, the local people probably know best how to handle arid ecosystems.
Sure, they have indigenous knowledge here is tremendous. Now, can we just focus on the loss to individual people, local people? Now, we're not talking about rich people here, we're talking about villagers who access collective pastures. And you describe them as losing their sources of water, firewood, traditional herbal medicines. I mean, you can't just brush this aside. These people don't have a lot. They need to get water. They need to collect firewood. They need their herbal medicines, and they just get shoved off. What have the countries been doing about these people? Have they just been saying, look, this is bad luck, off you go? Or have there been some type of reparation offered?
they kind of get ignored. I mean, you see this all over, well, large parts of Africa, you see it. It's not just this region, that people who still live in the countryside are kind of almost despised. They're rejected. They're thought of as sort of, you know, backwards people. They're not modern folk. You know, they're not getting with the, you know, international finance or industry or government or anything else. You know, these are people who try to live their own lives, and they do get rather despised. And so they get ignored, and their views get ignored, and their expertise and their knowledge gets ignored as well. So, that, you know, we talk about the Sahara Desert. Well, yeah, OK, it's an arid land, but it is still a really important habitat for all the reasons that you just stated, which are of absolutely critical importance for millions of people living in such ecosystems. And to ignore that and pretend that this is this kind of blank canvas on which we can start planting huge industrial plants, solar panels, you know, wind turbines and so on, is, you know, really very foolish. I mean, as an ecologist, we talk a lot about saving the rainforests. I'd like to save the deserts too.
Sure. Well, look, Fred, it's a pleasure to talk to you, but it's not always a pleasure to contemplate some of the issues we discuss. It's been a great pleasure having you back on Counterpoint today.
Thanks very much.
And in good environmental news, 29 threatened species back from the brink. Have you ever been chased by a cassowary? I have, and let me tell you, that beak is very large. And at the time, I did think, well, I don't care if you guys never exist. But when you see a picture of them, you realise they're beautiful. And there's good reason for it chasing me. It didn't get me, by the way. Anyway, the cassowary is one of the threatened species that now has a much better outlook, if you like. And there's some academics that have been working on this all around Australia. Charles Darwin University, University of Melbourne, Canberra, ANU, and they found 29 threatened species that are back from the brink. But there's a good story about how that happened. John Wynarski is one of those academics, and he joins us now. John, have you ever been chased by a cassowary?
No, I've never had that misfortune. I have seen them, but never been chased by them. They're wonderful birds, of course, Amanda.
I'm lucky I didn't divorce my husband at the time because he was just laughing. We were somewhere up in Queensland. I can't remember. They had cassowaries that you could sort of see if you went there. And they put bananas out to attract them to come down and see them. That all worked quite well, except I had a particular brand of camera that had a yellow and black strap, camera strap. And this particular cassowary took one look and thought that was the biggest banana that it had ever seen. So it wasn't really chasing me. It was chasing the camera strap. It was really quite frightening, and all my husband was doing was cracking up laughing. Anyway, I escaped, so all was well. Now, they're beautiful, but we focus a lot on the beautiful, the big and the beautiful, don't we, in terms of animals that are threatened. But really, is it 95% of the animals on the earth are made up of the spineless ones? What do we call those spineless ones again?
Yeah, invertebrates. They're really important.
Invertebrates,
you're right.
Yeah. Are they about 95% of?
Yeah, that's about right, yep.
Amazing, isn't it? Because we all think when you say animals, you think, oh, elephants, lions, tigers, cats, dogs. I don't think cockroaches, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, and they're important, aren't they? Because they play a role. We've all got our roles to play. And these little bugs down in the soil or on the plants are doing something in the ecosystem. They're important, aren't they?
Yeah, they're the building blocks for our whole natural system, and sort of much of the ecological function of our environments depends upon them for pollination, for dispersal of seeds, all sorts of things. They're incredibly important. And many invertebrates in Australia are extraordinarily ancient lineages. They've been in this continent for millions of years and are really key parts of our ecosystem.
So these invertebrates, because of the way they look, don't always attract our attention, do they? They in fact do the opposite. They make us run away.
Yeah, there's lots of biases in the way we view nature, and sort of it's an understandable human trait that we favour things like koalas as opposed to ants or cockroaches.
Now, could you run through a list, not necessarily all 29, but the ones that people might know of and think fondly of that are now in a better position than they were, where you guys get together and think, well, they're not as threatened as they were? What sort of animals are we talking about?
The humpback whale is one clear example that has recovered.
That gets a big tick, doesn't it?
The legislation's been changed, and the main factor affecting it, which was hunting, has now been stopped. So that's a really clear, explicit case of recovery due to better legislation.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of mammals that are on our list of species which we think are improving. So the most notable example of that is the burrowing beton, which is a very small macropod kangaroo-like thing that used to occur across about two-thirds of Australia.
It's cute. It looks like a little dumpling of a mouse. You know?
A bit bigger than a mouse, though, Amanda.
Is it?
Okay. And it was a really important species sort of in terms of Indigenous culture, but also ecologically it sort of burrowed extensively. And its huge population was wiped out by cats and foxes by about 1950.
We'll come back to the beetong. What else?
Gouldian finch is an interesting case. It's a beautiful bird from Northern Australia. Exquisite. Yeah. We were really concerned about its conservation status. It was becoming very close to extinction up till about the 1970s, but it's since made a recovery, which we think sort of it's done it on its own accord. So it's learnt to live in the
acclimatised environment.
Yeah, essentially it's evolved or learnt to adapt to a better environment or to a different environment in Northern Australia and is increasing its numbers and distribution. So this is, that's a sign of hope. There are cases that can actually improve themselves rather than us having to do all the hard work.
Yeah, they're good examples. I think we all like the idea of the cuddly beetong, if it is cuddly. It looks cuddly. The Gouldian finch and the humpback whale. And then there's a whole lot of others, many of which we might not know about but are important and play their role. Now, there's different ways to saving these. You've mentioned the Gouldian finch. There's a view that it might have done it itself. The beetong's a bit different, isn't it? That's reintroduced back onto islands when cats have been eradicated.
Yeah, absolutely. The beetong's an example of really hard work over about 20 or 30 years by a whole range of organisations that have figured out what the problem was, which is cat predation, figured out how to solve that, which is eradication of cats from islands or putting the beetongs back in the mainland in fenced areas where cats are excluded. And then doing that sort of hard work over 20 years, really collaboratively, clear vision, clear champions, and it's a success story and we've got to learn from those success stories. It's really important. It gives us hope.
Well, one of the aspects of that saving, if you like, is the islands, a closed off area where you can actually protect them to let them, you know, start again and regenerate. That's one aspect of it. Islands can be important in that context. But the other is this business of teamwork, working together, you know. People from one university or just legislation can't do it. I mean, legislation is another way. You mentioned that with the humpback whale. But really teamwork across sectors, across universities, but then with parliament and environmental groups working together. Isn't that right? No one can do this on their own.
Yeah, that's entirely right, Amanda. And we can all contribute in different ways. And I think that's an important lesson as well. And the conservation of Australian biodiversity is not a matter simply solely for the Commonwealth government, state, territory governments, local governments, councils, businesses, landholders, Indigenous groups and the general community. We've all got a role to play and we can all contribute and help make our environments better.
Mm. Now, if you had a magic wand and you could do two things tomorrow, what are the two things that you'd want to see Australia do if you could just have whatever you wanted?
Yeah, look, we've had an ongoing chronic decline for much of biodiversity in Australia for decades now. It's getting worse, and it's getting worse because of climate change. So the first thing we've got to do is actually tackle climate change far more effectively, otherwise the rate of loss of Australian biodiversity will escalate abominably. And we saw some of that with the Black Summer fires and those sorts of fires. Those environmental catastrophes at extensive scale will occur more frequently in the future unless we tackle climate change. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that our environmental legislation has a whole lot of suboptimalities about it, so it's really poor at preventing or curtailing or constraining habitat loss, land clearing. Logging of native forests is not well constrained by legislation. And those sort of pervasive factors are having a continuing impact on Australian biodiversity and we've got to do something better. So there's an opportunity now with review of Australia's environmental legislation to actually make it much better and more effective than it has been.
Both state and federal and probably some local government areas as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Local governments have an important part to play.
You know, I went recently to a concert in the Adelaide Hills. It was a beautiful setting called Eucharia, wonderful concert venue for music, perfect acoustics, all that sort of stuff. And you look out over these beautiful hills. But to get there, you drive through upcoming suburban development and you do that coming home as well. And you can't help but think when you're there amongst the gum trees and you see these beautiful birds, you know, rosellas, that sort of stuff. Where are they all going? With this expanding housing development. I mean, that is an example of local government. I know they want the money and I know people want houses to live in. I get that. But the more we keep doing that, the more we take away the homes of beautiful birds and right down to the little bugs, if you like, that are under the ground. So there's a bit of a conundrum, isn't there? Because we can't stop the world, but we do want to save these species.
That development pressure is an impact on the environment, which tends to be discounted. So for every extension of residential areas around our major cities, in the suburbs, in the rural cities, there will be a loss of biodiversity. And we're not counteracting that loss with sufficient benefits through other conservation measures. So, nature is on a pathway to severe decline. If we want our children to inherit a good world, then we need to improve on what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah. Are you of the view, I'm not suggesting you're a town planner or city planner, but you might have a view on this, whether we've made a mistake and we might be able to remedy this by not spending enough on decent infrastructure, that is rail transport, so that we could have outlying cities, which would allow much more in the way of corridors for native species, instead of just spreading out and squashing out the species where we develop. If we developed in pockets, there'd be gaps in between, flyways, if you like, areas where they could still thrive. What do you think of that? Or do you think we have to find some other solution?
Yeah, look, we do need to be far more strategic in our regional planning rather than the ad hoc development, which is going on largely at the present. And strategic planning at a regional scale will set aside some areas essentially for conservation or maintaining the natural environment. And then those other areas that are less important for the environment can be exposed to development pressures.
Mm.
And that seems to be the only way to go. We've got to be more systematic and strategic about the way our country is developing.
One of the things, John, that is on our side in terms of setting aside that space is that it's just a nicer place to live. I wouldn't want to live in one of those huge cities where you can drive for miles and miles and miles and there's nothing but tar and cement. It's important for us and our lifestyle to see green and birds and, animals and stuff. Even if you don't want to walk in it.
Yeah, no, sure, there's many studies now that demonstrate that sort of being in nature is really good for our well-being and that we're more calm, happier, and living better lives when there's bush around us and when we can communicate with nature in whatever form that takes. Maybe not being chased by cassowaries, but sort of much other of that. with nature is a wonderful experience.
In the photo in the conversation, that cassowary has a mean look in its eyes, if it's looking at me saying, I remember you and I'm going to get you. John Wynarski, thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you,
and bringing us some good news. Good news. 29 threatened species back from the brink. Yay, keep at it.
Yeah, no, great. It's really good to have inspiration and hope. And thanks very much for talking with us, Amanda.
That's the program for this week. Thanks for joining, and I hope you join again next week. As ever, I remind you to tell us whatever you want to say. Yes, Mark, I do see the emails. Thanks for the comments on nuclear energy and on universities. Until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying see you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.